Where's Charlie? I'm touching it one time only. Hi, everybody. My name's Tammy, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be here this morning. Heck, I'm grateful to be anywhere this morning sober, that's for sure, because it wasn't always the case, right? I want to thank Vanessa and my friend Mark for asking me to come out and share. It is always a privilege and an honor to be asked to share in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. My mom died about 4 years ago, and I would travel and get on planes and stuff, and she used to always say, Tammy, why would anyone want to hear that horrible, horrible time in our lives? And she never really understood why anybody would want to hear anything I had to say, because I sure drug her through a lot of pain and suffering. And I said, because Mom, people that went before me shared too. I want to really, really thank my husband for joining me. My husband has 43 years of sobriety. And we do this together. And I enjoy going to AA with my husband. I enjoy being with my husband. It is no longer like sleeping in the enemy camp like it was before sobriety, right? And I want to thank all my friends. I want to thank Charles for such a beautiful talk. And how many of you heard Charles last night? Ah, it's so emotional. You know, when we get up here and share, it's a story to the audience, but for us, we see it in our heads as you do when you share. But what you may not have been aware of, I think he alluded to it, you know, to share a story like that in front of his wife, his child, and his grandchild, you know, it really touched me. And just what an incredible example you've always been to me of a gentleman in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my husband and I and our entire home group at the time, I was a member of the Pacific group, I've since relocated, we were able to go to his son's memorial. And I mean, I'd never been more proud of a home group than I was that day, because everybody showed up for this beautiful broken family. And you know, these are the things we get to enjoy when we become members of a home group and we're active participative members, because we take care of each other. I want to thank Darren for kicking us off on Friday night, and I've been dying to meet Darren. And what a little charmer he is, right? and my friend Becky, who I've known almost her entire sobriety, and my friend Sarah back there, who picked us up from the airport. You know, I've moved to Northern California with my husband, and you know, has driven us everywhere and will be taking us back to the airport at night. So I've really enjoyed company with my friends. And of course, my buddy Mark. Mark and I got sober together pretty much. And you'll hear in my story, my ex-husband was an OBGYN and he actually delivered Mark's daughter. And, you know, when you come into Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I came in with these little Daisy Duke shorts and these little tube tops and low-cut shorts. And then the old timers cleaned me up really quickly, you know. Clean up your filthy language, quit dressing like a whore, I think they said. But there's always a few people that saw you come in that remember, and they love to trip down memory lane when you're in a meeting. Oh, I remember when Tammy came in with those little shorts. I was a lot younger then, but so be it. Anyway, let's get into some recovery here. I'm describing the book Alcoholics Anonymous as an alcoholic that is never mildly intoxicated. I'm always more or less insanely drunk. I'm described in AA vernacular. Oh, I forgot my AA resume. My sobriety date is April 24th, 1993. I have 31 years of sobriety. I did share my husband has 43 years, and we have a son that has 10 years. So we have 83 years of recovery in our home. So I am a huge proponent of Alcoholics Anonymous, the tradition, singleness of purpose, because our lineage seems to be a little bit in our family that I want to make sure this thing is alive and well for my little beautiful little grandsons and for all of you and your families as well. My home group is now, this is still hard for me to say, it was the Pacific group, but it is the Geyserville Good Neighbors group in Cloverdale, California. We live about an hour and a half north of San Francisco now. We retired up there. It's God's country. I moved to the wine country and I'm sober, but it's beautiful. We back up to a 100-year-old farm. I garden, and we've got a horse that gardens alongside me. It's my neighbor's horse, and it's beautiful up there. And my sponsor is Pat Y. Clancy was my sponsor. Sometimes one person said, you know, that's like really name dropping. Yeah, I don't care. I got the mic. And and what I loved about Clancy is his primary purpose, not his secondary, not his tertiary. His primary purpose in life was, first, he stayed sober himself, and he dedicated his entire sober life to helping other alcoholics. And how many of us really live up to that ideal? And I can honestly say he lived it in person, and I was able to have a front row seat to watching that. Clancy cared way more about my life than he did about my feelings, as does Pat. And you know what? That's kept me in good stead. I don't need somebody to embellish my feelings, because I will feel my way right out the door. But I'm grateful to those men and women that walked before me, that told me the truth in the name of me, maybe being able to bridge that gap from drunkenness into sobriety. So like I said, I'm an alcoholic. It's never mildly intoxicated. It mentions that in the book. I'm always insanely drunk. So I'm like either sober or drunk. There's like no in between for me. I'm also described in AA vernacular, it's not described in the book, as a puking blackout drinker. I do not like the taste of alcohol. I never liked the taste of alcohol. Toward the end of my drinking, I used to have to uncap the vodka and plug my nose, and then I'd have to guzzle as much vodka as I could keep down and still keep my nose plugged, because if I smelled the vodka, I'd start to retch and gag and puke it all up before it would heat up my chest and produce that ease and that comfort, and then I'd puke the whole thing up. I am that hideously and physically allergic to alcohol from day one. As a kid, I kind of had like a fairly, you know, cushy childhood up until I was about 9. I had a mom, I had a dad. My parents were really well known in the community. My mom was president of the PTA. My dad, both my parents were professional athletes. They came to the United States as professional ice skaters. My mom was in the Olympics. They skated for Holiday on Ice. And then they came to America and they opened up this huge ice skating rink in Tarzana, California, where I grew up. And every kid that I went to school with either took hockey lessons from my dad or figure skating lessons from my mom. So my family was a really well-known family in the community. But at 9 years old, my parents went through an incredibly acrimonious divorce. It was actually due to an infidelity on my mom's part. And like, I felt as a kid at 9 years old that my parents were the first parents in my elementary school to ever get a divorce. And that's the time I first recognized that selfish, self-centered fear that I've carried throughout my whole life. But of course, I don't understand that at 9 years old. I don't know that that's what that was, but I felt like the whole world was looking at our family, and for some reason, I assigned myself the role of being the bow on a package of a broken family. And I was just this intense little kid. So like, I would go to school and I couldn't get a B, I like had to get A's so that my teachers all praised me, so that it made my parents look like at least they did right by me. And then because my parents were professional athletes, I was always a little tomboy and a very athletic kid. And we ended up losing our house. My dad wouldn't pay alimony or child support, and my mom ended up being forced out of our house, and I was so humiliated as a kid because we had this beautiful ranch home, and now I'm living in an apartment with my mom and my sister. And across the street, they built this huge tennis complex. This is when tennis was in its heyday, of 16 tennis courts, and they put a very famous tennis pro to run this huge tennis complex. And every day at 9 years old, I would come home from school, change out of my clothes, school clothes, do my homework, and go across to the sports complex. And I used to watch like Wimbledon and tennis on TV, and I'd see the ball girls and the ball boys wearing all whites, you know, running back and forth at the net and throwing the players' balls. Well, they used to have these big celebrity pro-am tennis matches at this big complex, and they'd film them on TV. And I just decided at 9 years old, I'm going to be the self-appointed ball girl. So I got myself little white shorts and a white shirt and white tennis shoes, and I'd be in these matches running and throwing the players' balls, and they would give me quarters and tip me. And I was just this really intense little kid. I didn't want to go to school and play with my school friends. I loved school, but I didn't want to hang out with school friends. And every single day after school, I would do this, and then I would help this guy at closing time around 8 o'clock clean everything up. And I think this tennis pro recognized that I was a troubled little kid. I was really having a lot of problems at this time. But my intensity was just, I'm a straight A student. I'm, you know, everything's like regimented and perfect. Like, I needed a drink at 9, trust me. And he used to have this electric ball machine. And one day I just picked up a racket and the machine, and I turned it on because I used to turn it on for the players. And I started hitting the balls back and forth. And the tennis coach noticed that I had a propensity for hand-eye racket sports. And I think more out of pity, every single day after that, he would coach me for 20 minutes when the whole complex was cleaned up. And by the time I was 12, I was starting to win a lot of local tennis tournaments in the area. And he kind of became my coach, and I became his little protege. And I'm not kidding you. My whole laser focus was I had a decision. At 9, I made this decision. I'm going to become a tennis pro, and I'm going to make a boatload of money, and I'm going to support my mom, my sister, and I in the manner that we deserve. And that was my only focus in life. It was laser focus. So I'd go to school, and I had to make straight A's, and I'm eating brown rice and yogurt and kashi for breakfast because my body is a shrine, and I'm going to be a pro athlete. And I'm out there doing drills, and I was just this really tightly wound, intense little kid. Well, a byproduct of my parents getting divorced is that I had to start spending weekends with my dad. I never remember a time that I was not frightened of my dad. I just always had this like visceral reaction when my dad was around me. And our stories disclose in a general way from the podium, so I am not gonna go into detail other than to say when I started to have to spend weekends with my dad, those fears were founded. And let's just say if you were a girl and you had a budding teenage body, you were not safe to spend a weekend alone with my dad. And that went on for several years, and I kept that like dirty little secret because my mom, sadly, right after the divorce, had an attempt at suicide. And I was so afraid that if I did anything to put my mom off the edge, she'd take her life. I don't want to be stuck with my dad. And so I just took all these adult problems on as some little kid. And I don't know why I did that. And I later realized in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and like it says, you know, I can't handle change. I need to control everything in my external environment because I'm so out of control inside. But I don't understand that as a kid. I don't even know what an alcoholic is. Anyway, by the time I'm 15, my tennis coach is recognizing now that just going to high school is not a good enough level of play for me in tennis. I'm really winning some good tournaments in the United States Lawn and Tennis Association. And he knew I was a good reader. I believe my first addiction was reading. In fact, I just retired 2 years ago from a 28-year career as a high school English teacher. I loved literature. As a kid, I would escape to faraway lands and happy families through books. To this day, you know, it's funny how every speaker shared that they have a shyness and a self-consciousness about them. I can talk to a room full of people, but one-on-one, I still feel so socially awkward, and I'm still my happiest. My husband can verify if I'm in bed curled up with a good book or by the fireplace. That's where I feel safe. I have learned to like the concept of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have learned to love many of you very deeply, but I'm still a little like people reluctant. Well, back then as a kid, I was this ferocious reader. My tennis pro knew that, and so he told me about this GED exam that I could take and get out of high school early. So it's not a thought that originates in my head, but I go, okay, I'll take it. So at 16 years old, I sign up for this GED exam, and I take this exam, and it's like a 5-hour test in different subcategories, science, history, math, and all that. And if you pass the test, it's equivalent to having a high school diploma. And just about 6 weeks after my 16th birthday, I find out that indeed I have passed this GED exam and now I have a high school diploma. Well, my tennis pro is recognizing that something's not right with me when I'm coming home from weekends with my dad. And I did open up and kind of let him know that I didn't feel safe with my dad. So he talked to my mom and he said, look, he said, you're trying to work full time to support your kids. Tammy really needs to play like a lot more local tournaments, but at a further distance. I'm gonna have her enroll in community college and get her on the tennis team. I have a condominium with an extra unit. If you're comfortable with it, why don't you let Tammy stay with me and I'll get her to school every morning and I'll get her, help her with her studies in college. She can come home obviously to your mom anytime you want. And I'll, kind of really get her because she has a chance of actually making the junior pro circuit. And my mom agreed to it because she's trying to struggle, support two kids, work two jobs. So I moved in with my tennis pro. He was 40, I was 15 or 16. And for obvious reasons, I was a very sexualized 16-year-old. And after a few months, sadly, he fell to the temptation. And then I just became his live-in girlfriend. So I'm still a tennis protege and I'm not going to high school and I'm living with a 40-year-old man. And that goes on for a while. And at no point is drinking any big part of my life, but every couple of months, I would just kind of go off as a kid. And I think, you know, we can analyze it and get into all the therapy. I'm sure it was a lot of built-in rage, but I would just come home, and I knew before it was going to happen because my hands would start to shake. I didn't want people around me or touching me. And then I'd just, like, pull my whole bedroom down, or I'd just start throwing things around the house. And then I'd go find those people that I knew drank. And I wasn't a drinker. I was like an athlete, you know, who treated my body like a shrine. And I would go find those drinkers, and I'd go just get drunk, like just guzzling drinking, not even to socialize. And because I'm an alcoholic, like the book says, it's never mildly intoxicated, I'd go into one of those blackouts, and I would do strange and incredible things drunk that I would be mortified to do in a sober state of mind. And both times that I did this, but when I lived with that older guy, I got arrested for public drunkenness. And so they put me in one of those lockdown facilities for adolescents because I'm under the age of 18. So I'm in this Woodview, Calabasas-like psych ward for adolescents. And the big pink elephant is they walked me through those double doors, cussing like a drunken sailor and fighting cops and drunker than a skunk slurring my words. And within 24 hours of sobering up, they started looking at those childhood issues and the childhood abuse with my dad, and the diagnosis was always the same: emotional and mental disorders, trauma due to childhood, post-traumatic stress syndrome, nothing to do with the alcohol. And they did what the medical model will do. I don't understand that I suffer from a spiritual malady. I don't suffer from a medical problem. I suffer from a spiritual problem. And the solution for a spiritual problem is a spiritual solution, but I keep going to the medical model to solve a spiritual solution. So they tell me I'm clinically depressed because of my childhood, and they gave me antidepressants. I told them that when I'd have these going off periods and just going, you know, like ballistic, they gave me something for anxiety when I felt those coming on so that I wouldn't, you know, do that. And I'm having trouble sleeping at night now, and so they give me something for insomnia. Go to the medical model, you'll get a medical solution. The problem is nothing got better. Well, by the time I'm 18 years old, I graduate that community college, and because I was a straight-A student and I won all kinds of awards, the chancellor gave me a certificate called the Chancellor's Award, and they gave it to about 6 students in the entire college. And if you demonstrated some type of athletic and/or academic excellence, that scholarship afforded me a chance to go to any one of 5 state universities. They were all good universities. And as long as I agreed to play on their tennis team and take 12 units or more, they would pay my tuition, my housing, my textbook, and money for living expenses. And guess what I did, guys? There's my drinkers. I quit. I could get away from my dad. I can get away from my older boyfriend. I could pursue my dream of becoming a tennis pro. But like the book says, we have special skills, aptitudes, and abilities. We can build a bright outlook, not only for ourselves, but for our loved ones. And then we pull the whole thing down over our head with a senseless series of sprees. You know, I sponsor a lot of women, and they always think, you know, Tammy, I have a huge fear of failure. I mean, of failure. And you know, that's not what the book tells me. I don't have a fear of failure. When I fail, I'm comfortable because nobody expects anything from me. Don't expect Tammy to show up for Christmas, and if I do, it's like, oh, yay, look who showed up, right? Don't expect Tammy to finish anything like college or any of her dreams, but if I do, oh, yay. What I have a fear of is success. Because I intuitively know at some very deep level that I am a great starter, but I cannot sustain anything. And I know it at a very deep level. And that's what the book's describing there. But I don't understand that that's part of alcoholism because I don't know what an alcoholic is. So I get all the way to getting a college scholarship and a chance to fulfill my dream. And I decide to quit college. And for the next 2 years, I do what I do best, which is drinking in really chaotic relationships. So now I'm 18 years old, and tennis is in its heyday in LA. And back in LA in the late 80s, if you had blonde hair, blue eyes, tan skin, a white tooth smile, and a really good tennis game, I could hang out at the Malibu Tennis Club. Hugh Hefner used to have his scouts come down and give me a couple $100 to play at his celebrity matches at the Playboy Mansion. No, I never saw the grotto. Yes, I was always dressed. But I was like a little 18-year-old ringer, and I'd be there playing with, like, I won't mention the celebrities' names, but a bunch of celebrities. They all sucked at tennis. They all thought they were great. You know, and Hugh would sit in this big white umpire chair, and he used to call me Tammy the Tiger, you know, and this is what I did. I just threw away a whole college and tennis career to play at Hefner's Mansion for a couple $100 with my little girlfriends, right? And this is what I'm doing. And during this time, I'm still living with my 40-year-old boyfriend, and I cheat on him, and he throws me out, and then he takes me back, and we make up, and we break up in that craziness we live in relationships, and we're not sober. But on the way home one day from one of those things, I got a felony DUI, and it really scared me. And I'm facing, you know, having to go to court. And so I do what the book says. I swear off alcohol with a solemn oath. I'm never going to drink again. You know how we do. It says some of us swear off with or without a solemn oath. With me, it's always some big ritual. And I make a decision that, you know what, I'm going to go back to school and re-enroll in school, because when I'm in school, that structure and that discipline keeps me from going off the deep end. So this time I decide 12 units wasn't enough. Maybe that was a problem. I'm going to go for 15. And I can't be a tennis pro anymore, and I've got that kind of ego that if I can't be the best and get attention at something, I don't want to do it. So this time I decide I'm going to become a triathlete. So I go down to the local health food store, and I want brown rice and yogurt and kashi for breakfast because my body is a shrine. And I'm taking 15 units, and I cannot get an A. I've got to get an A. And I'm swimming laps, and I'm riding mountain bikes, and I'm lifting weights and doing the same thing, expecting different results. And during this time of swearing off, I met the man that later went on to be my husband of 21 years, Dr. Rick. He's the one that delivered Mark's daughter. Rick was an OBGYN. And he moved right into the condominium complex that was vacated next to my boyfriend, my tennis pro boyfriend and I. And I meet Dr. Rick, and I see this tall, handsome guy moving in, and he's got a triathlete shirt on, and I sidle over, and I'm like, hi, Rick, my name's Tammy, and I'm your new neighbor, and I see you're a triathlete. He says, I am. He goes, you know, I just got out of a 10-year marriage, and this is just kind of my first place out of my marriage. And I'm like, out of a marriage, ding, 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 right? And, you know, the fact I'm living next door with a guy that's paid my rent and all my tuition and everything for 7 years, yeah, that's just an incidental. You know how we roll, right? And I'm attracted to him, and he's attracted to me, and I'm sashaying away. And he says, do you know any good gyms in the area? And as a matter of fact, I do. And the next day, he and I run like a couple of miles in the neighborhood, and then we're lifting weights at the gym, and every Wednesday he has off of his medical practice, and while my boyfriend's out teaching tennis lessons and paying all my bills, you know, I'm laying out by the pool with Dr. Rick, and I could tell Dr. Rick had a big crush on me, and I played it for all it's worth. But poor Dr. Rick met me in a swearing off period. And my swearing off periods and brief intervals of recovery are becoming shorter and shorter, and one night my tennis pro boyfriend came home, and he had some tequila, and he poured some shooters of tequila, and I joined him, and I call it tequila if you're an alcoholic of my type, and I did the plug and chug, puked it up, and we got into one of those knockdown physical drag out fights that at least Tammy Tyson is my nickname when I was drinking, knows how to do, and he's 6 feet, and I'm all of like 5'1", and I have knocked him out twice with you know, like a right hook. I'm a violent little drunk, and Dr. Rick hears the fighting next door because there's just a wall separating our units. So Dr. Rick hears me screaming and carrying on, and he calls the police. He later said he was surprised the police never asked for a unit number because they'd been there before. And they're at the door, and my pro boyfriend, I don't like to mention his name because he's well known, but my tennis pro boyfriend's talking to the police, and Dr. Rick is standing behind, you know, the police going, is Tammy okay? Is Tammy okay? And the police separate us and tell us that one of us needs to go spend the night somewhere else, which of course we never do after the police leave. And we get rid of Dr. Rick, and we get rid of the police, and then, you know, my tennis pro boyfriend and I go upstairs and do one of those all-night, you know, passionate makeups the way we do after we beat the crap out of each other and talk about each other's mothers, and we profess our love to each other all night like a bad Hallmark card. And, you know, the next day I wake up and I do exactly what's described in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, that after a while, a drinking alcoholic cannot separate the true from the false. The only life we come to understand is our drinking life. And I thought nothing the next morning of taking a little liquid makeup, covering up the marks on my face from the fight the night before, putting a backpack on my back and going off to Cal State University Northridge like there's nothing wrong with my life. I sit in classes all day and I'm hearing lectures. I'd been drinking the night before, so I'm hungover. We've physically gotten an altercation, so my body hurts. I'm listening to lectures and my mind hurts. And about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I park at that subterranean parking in that condominium unit, and I get out of my car, and as I'm walking toward the elevator, my jaw is tight, my back is rigid, I'm restless, I'm irritable, I'm discontented, and life flipping hurts. And I'm just walking, and everything's just a difficult procedure to even walk. And as I'm walking toward the elevator, a thought occurs to me. Liquid relief is just moments away. There's a huge bottle of vodka waiting for me in our kitchen on the third floor. And I get in the elevator and I go to push button number 3. Now my jaw's loosened up, my back is relaxed, I'm feeling happy. I haven't seen the vodka, I haven't smelled the vodka, and I haven't ingested the vodka. But thinking about a clear liquid that looks no less innocuous than the water in this bottle my entire persona changes. And if you identify with that, you're probably an alcoholic, because clear liquids do not have a power and a voice over other people like it does us. So I'm waiting for liquid relief, and right as I go to push button number three, there's Dr. Rick right at the door. And now I'm pushing the closed door button because I don't want to get stuck in an elevator with a guy that called the police on me the night before. And his hand wedged between those elevator doors, and he got into the elevator, and he said, "Tammy, you and I need to know, talk about what happened last night." And prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and having a sponsor like Clancy, who told me to clean up my filthy language, and having male mentors like Charles and Patrick and Mark, who treated me like a lady before I even knew what a lady was, I used to use a tremendous amount of foul language, a tremendous amount of inappropriate sexual attire, sexual body language, and sexual humor to keep especially you men like a little bit off your footing with me, because it made me feel like I had some kind of control over the situation. So I pull out the tough, brash street girl, and I turn to Dr. Rick, and I go, "You effing know what happened last night. You're the one that called the effing cops on me, and I don't want to effing talk about it." And instead of him doing the usual, like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, okay, okay," he put his hand on my shoulder and he moved into me. And that really disarmed me. So I realized the tough, cussing, brash street girl wasn't gonna back him up, because I have crippled language. I don't know how to communicate like an articulate woman. So I grabbed his silk Fastenal tie and I yanked his neck like right into my nose, and I took a deep whiff and I said, "My God, Dr. Rick, your cologne, you always smell so delicious." And he didn't bite that bait either, and he took his other hand and he put it on my other shoulder, and he looked at me with... he looked at me with his beautiful brown eyes of his, and he said, "Sweetheart," he goes, "I have come to really care about you, and you're such an engaging, enterprising young woman. And I can tell that you're struggling with something. And I don't know if it's the compassionate man in me or the doctor in me, but I want to help you, kid. But I don't know what's wrong with you." And that's the worst thing you can hear if you're an alcoholic suffering from alcoholism. Because I've had enough therapy as an adolescent to find out that I'm never going to be normal because of my childhood abuse. And the best hope for me is medical management through psychiatry and medications. And I am so afraid because I know I'm not normal. I got a fire in me that makes me do stuff that I don't even want to do. And I am so afraid that you're going to know I'm crazy. So at 20-something years old now, my job is that I'm going to pretend I'm okay because I don't want you to know that I know I'm not okay. And now another person, bam, has hit me in the eyes with the truth. But I am now at the point in my drinking where I'm constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself about the role that alcohol plays in my life, and more importantly, the role I play in the lives of other people under the influence of alcohol. But for whatever reason, and today I do believe it was the grace of God, I got off that elevator and I told Dr. Rick the cry of every drinking alcoholic. I told him about the abuse, and I told him about living with, you know, the older man because I had protective protection from my dad. And I told him, "One day I'm going to finish my college degree. And when I finish my college degree, one day I'm going to have a good job. And when I have a good job, one day I'm going to be able to support myself and not live with abusive men. And one day and one day and one day," because the cry of every drinking alcoholic is, "Look, I know my life looks a little whack, but I have a plan. And when that plan comes together, it's going to all be okay." Newcomers, every alcoholic has a plan. It's never a good plan. That's why we need to be sponsored. And for God's sakes, newcomer, pick a sponsor whose voice is louder than your head. Because I always have a plan, and thank God both Clancy and Pat White, their voice is louder than my head, and like Charles shared, they will get me to take actions that I do not believe in and that I don't want to take in the name of something better based on their longevity and experience. And for whatever reason, I have always listened to my sponsors, except one time, and I paid dearly for it. Anyway, I broke down and I cried for the first time like the broken little girl I was and always had been. No more tough cussing bravado Tammy, no more sexual seductress Tammy. I broke down and I sobbed, and Dr. Rick held me, and to this day, I still feel like that was probably the most intimate moment I had ever shared with a man up until that point, because he held me and I let him hold me and I felt safe. and I went to my condominium, that unit, after I cried, and I never did drink that vodka that I'd been thinking about in the parking garage. And I think that release of just crying, I was literally able to just go to sleep that night without drinking myself to sleep. But I woke up the next day and I felt the fear they talk about in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. That fear that comes in 100 different forms. That fear that guides an alcoholic's actions and behaviors, because another human being saw the broken truth about Tammy, and I'm constitutionally incapable of being able to handle that truth. And I did the only thing an alcoholic knows how to do. When they don't have a God that to pray to for strength, and they don't have friends like Becky or Cheryl that I can just talk up and talk those dumb women alcoholic fears through with, and I went to the only thing that ever takes away the big ow, and I poured myself that drink of vodka the next morning at 9 a.m. I plugged my nose, I downed as much of it as I could keep down, it heated up my chest, it gave me that airy feeling in my head, and then I came up with yet another alcoholic plan. And my plan was I had the key to Dr. Rick's condominium unit, because I used to take care of his exotic fish when he would travel the country for medical conventions, and I knew that he had a huge crush on me, and things weren't working out with my tennis pro boyfriend. I'm circling the drain, and I know I'm about to be kicked out. So my plan was to just take all my stuff and move it out of my condominium unit with my tennis pro and move it into Dr. Rick's unit. And I literally, all by myself, just spent the day drunk moving. I remember even getting refills during the day and just kept moving. My boyfriend came home after 7 years of putting me through school. You know, he was not a bad man. He was definitely a weak man. And he fell to a horrible temptation. But I do need to qualify that he paid so highly for that price. When I was not doing well and I was drinking, he was devastated. And I have received a card from him every year on my sober birthday because he felt so responsible for taking me in at 40 years old and what happened. Where was I? I forget my story now. Oh, yeah. So he comes home and I'm completely moved out. I mean, there I weren't, just gone. Dr. Rick came home that afternoon, and there I were with dinner on the table. And you know, my goal, literally, these are the kinds of decisions I make when I drink, is that I saw the pity in Dr. Rick's eyes the night before when I broke down sobbing, and I knew that I could replace that pity in his eyes with admiration if I could be Tammy the seductress. And my goal was to just move in and get him between the sheets and get him to fall to the temptation too. And where's my Al-Anons in the room tonight? Can you all raise your hands? You guys will get this. They don't. I don't get it. Dr. Rick not only let me stay, but 3 weeks later, he walked me down the aisle and he said, I do. And the day he said, I do was the day he qualified for Al-Anon, because his life was not the same. Look, Dr. Rick grew up in a horribly abusive home. He also got out of such a painful childhood through academia. Dr. Rick was so brilliant that he made it to high school at 12. He made it to college at 16. He made it to medical school at 20. And at 24 years old, and those of you that have kids or those of you that are young in this room, think about it. At 24 years old, they shipped him off at the tail end of the Vietnam War as a medical flight surgeon. And he's in Thailand at a medical base sewing our boys' bodies up as they're being blown apart and medevaced into his hospital. And he survived a very, very painful and abusive 10-year marriage. So he survived a seriously abusive childhood, that Vietnam War and the traumas that he saw through that, and having to make decisions who gets to live and who gets to die, and they're 18. And a horribly abusive marriage. And he survived all that, yet being married to me for just a couple of years. He would like stutter and stammer. He didn't even know his own shadow, because I'm not a funny drunk. And I'm not here to tell you jokes so you can roll down the aisles laughing. I emasculated him. I humiliated him. And he paid a price for a crime he never committed. Dr. Rick paid the price for every man out in the streets that had no respect for women. He paid the price for what my dad had done all those years. And because he was pre-Al-Anon and pre-a-program of recovery for himself, he sadly took the butt kicking and I damn near destroyed his soul. So Al-Anons, I salute you, because you gave him a backbone and a spine to stand up to the insidiousness of my drinking. But that marriage produced two children, and today I have a daughter, Chelsea, that's 38, and I have a son, Alex, that's 35. And through the grace of God, I was so physically sick with both my pregnancies. I had a condition called hyperemesis, where I didn't puke the first 9 months. I puked the first 3 months, I puked the entire pregnancy. I gave birth to my daughter, and 6 weeks after I give birth to my daughter, I find out I'm pregnant again with my son. Dr. Rick, like, hates me sharing that. He's an OBGYN. You should wait, like, at least 12 weeks. And I go another 9 months pregnant, but I was so physically sick, I could not stand the smell of alcohol. And I went an entire 24 months without picking up a drink. But I wake up one morning, and I've got this beautiful one-year-old baby boy, one-year-old baby girl, a brand new little baby boy. I'm living in a five-bedroom house with a pool and a basketball court, four-car garage, all kinds of fancy cars in the garage paid for. I'm married to an OBGYN, and all of a sudden I realize that I'm living in this big adult life, and I am a completely crippled human being. And I felt the fear they talk about in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And one more time, I did the only thing an alcoholic knows how to do when they feel that fear, and I picked up a drink. And the book says that many women in particular go beyond recognition in a short period of time, and that was certainly my story, because in those 2 years that I was pregnant and didn't drink, that malady had really progressed, and I would say within about 3 months, I became around-the-clock drunk, and my entire focus on life was drinking but trying to be a good mom, and that's like, it doesn't work. Anyway, things got so bad that with my drinking and, you know, my mom's noticing, my sister, and everybody's noticing. And one day I pick a fight because I need a drink with Dr. Rick. I get out, I go down to the liquor store, I buy a little bottle of vodka, I plug my nose, I down it as quickly as I can. It takes effect, and I get on the 118 freeway, I crank up my radio, roll down the windows, and I'm back to who I was when I was 16 years old. And I see a call box on the freeway, and I remember thinking it was a payphone, and I'm like, I'm gonna make a phone call. And I plow my car in this call box. And if you ever hit a call box, about 30 days later, you're gonna get something in the mail which says like the United States government or whatever versus Tammy Pearsall. Apparently it's federal property or some whatever. And I get this thing, and now I've got my second felony DUI. And I got a 6-week-old baby and a 1-year-old daughter. So 30 days later, I'm sitting in front of a woman judge. She's reading my rap sheet. She goes, you know, your rich surgeon husband isn't going to buy you out of this. You're going to do some time. However, I'm going to waive 30 days of your sentence, and I'm going to put you in a lockdown unit for the first time for alcoholism. And I go into that lockdown unit, and those doctors told me what they've been telling me since I was 15 years old. Tammy, you're clinically depressed as a result of your childhood. And I said, look, I'm at the point now where first I drank to feel good, then I drank to feel normal, and now I drink not to feel. And they said, you are clinically depressed, it's because of your abuse, none of this is your fault. Later, when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, old timers like Mark, Patrick, Clancy had a new name for the effect that appeared to have on me, alcohol appeared to have on me, is described word for word in the doctor's opinion of this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. They suggested I may be alcoholic. In that lockdown facility, I told those doctors, I'd go drinking and I'd, you know, wake up in the morning and after a blackout, and I'd go downstairs, I'd see broken glass, broken children, a broken husband, a broken home. I'd go upstairs, turn the heating blanket up to mom, suck my thumb, and think of ways to kill myself. And I had an attempt at suicide when my daughter was 5. And at 5 years old, she had to call 911 because I had tried to overdose on some medications and I didn't even know what it was. And those doctors told me that the best hope for me is medical management because of the abuse I faced as a child, that I'm not wired right, and none of this is my fault. Later, when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous for a buck in a basket, the old timers had a new name for a mother that was willing to attempt taking her own life in front of her 5-year-old child and her, you know, 4-year-old son without giving a crap how it would affect those kids, my husband, my mom. They called it alcoholism, selfishness, self-centeredness. The world always revolved around my childhood pain. Forgetting my kids are in their childhood, it's always about Tammy. In that lockdown facility, I told those doctors that in my swearing off periods, I'd go down to the local gym, work out with all you men, of course. And then I'd take my husband's credit card and buy drinks on his dime, always playing the big shot, taking credit for money I didn't even earn. And in that lockdown facility, the doctors told me taking my husband's credit card and buying men, you know, things and drinks and all that was really my way of buying love that I've been so poorly robbed of from my father in my childhood. But none of those actions are my fault. Later, when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, an old timer named Clancy had a new name for that behavior too. He called it stealing. And not only did I steal my husband's money and play big shot on his dime, but I'd meet men at the gym and I'd take them to those creepy daytime motels down at Sepulveda Boulevard. And let's just say I did in those motel rooms what drunken alcoholic women do. And in that lockdown facility, they told me that my dad gave me a script when I was a kid that my only worth was my sexuality. So all I was doing in those motel rooms was acting out a script I'd been so poorly given as a kid. But none of those actions in those motel rooms were my fault. Later, when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, the old timers had a new name for that too. They called it cheating. By the time I came to AA, my mom and my husband had paid for 4 lockdown facilities to find out that living inside of Tammy was a hurt child due to a discontented childhood and a lack of love as a kid with abuse. And for a buck in a basket, the old timer said, "Babe, you're a liar, you're a cheat, you're a thief, and you may just be an alcoholic suffering from alcoholism. And God, I needed it to be so much more." You know, young people in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a universal truth in these rooms that's not mentioned in this book. You don't like the old timers? Don't worry about it. You're never going to be one, you know? Our old timers, I had a newcomer one time say, "You know, those old timers think they know it all." I got news for you. When it comes to recovery from alcoholism, they do. They know more than medical science, I'm telling you. Anyway, the condition of my getting out of that lockdown facility is I have to start attending AA meetings. I come to meetings late. I leave meetings early. I wear little low-cut tops and these little Daisy Duke shorts. I was a lot younger back then. And I spent half of my time in the parking lot flirting with you men, and I took 5 30-day chips. I'll never forget my last chip, because I stood at a podium and I told y'all something about God and how wonderful my life was. But what I didn't tell you is that my mom, my sister, and my husband had gone down to family court, and they had taken custody of my 2 children away from me. And I had stood in a courtroom with a woman, and she hit a gavel and told me that I could not come within 100 yards of my children, of their daycare or kindergarten, of my husband's medical practice, or of our home, and I had to go. And I got off the podium taking that chip, and I went out and I got drunk for the last time. And I came to 3 days later, and to this day, 30 years later, I have no recollection of where I went or what happened in those 3 days. But when I resurfaced, I called my husband like, "Hey, I'm back." And he served me with the restraining order. And I said, "Rick, where am I gonna go?" And he said, "I don't know, Tammy, but you need to go." And he said, "You come and pick up a few things at 7 o'clock tonight at the house. Your kids and I and your mom have been through hell and back. You've been on a 3-day run, and we're calling hospitals and morgues trying to look for you." And he said, "And when you find a permanent place to live, I will send you money every month, and I will send you your stuff. But for God's sakes, woman, leave me and the kids alone." And thank you, Al-Anon, for giving him the backbone and not telling him he's 50% responsible if I kill my kids. His Al-Anon said, "She puts those kids in a car and kills them. You're 100% responsible, Dr. Rick, because she cannot make a sober decision for himself." And he and my mom and my sister finally had the courage to stand up to me. I went to that home at 7 o'clock at night, and somewhere in that afternoon, I died. There was no fight left. I had no more good ideas. I had no more plans. I wasn't thinking about, "I'm gonna do this and I'm gonna do that." I was dead. And as I got to the house, I walked up the stairs of that home that I had brought those kids home from 5 and 6 years earlier after I'd given birth to them. And I remember my body moving, like propelling me up the stairs, and I remember a ringing in my ears, but it was the first time I had no thought or idea or fight left. And that's a really good place to be if you're gonna surrender to this sucker. And I went in my bedroom and I took a gym bag and I threw some sweats and some t-shirts and toiletries, and I walked out in the hall and I said to Rick, "I know I need to go, buddy, like, I wanna go. There's something just innately wrong with me, and I really don't want to hurt you guys anymore." And I said, "But would you just let me say goodbye to Chelsea and Alex before I leave?" And he said, "Sweetheart, your kids have been through hell and back, and they're asleep in their rooms." He said, "You can look in on them, but for once in your life, Tammy, do not wake up your children." And on April 23rd, 1993, I grabbed my son Alex's door handle to his bedroom. And as I opened the door, the hall light went down on my son. And I'm really embarrassed to say this, but I saw my son for the first time, and he was 5. And I saw him the way a mother's supposed to see him. He wasn't this cute little kid that I dressed cute and went around and said, it's my son. I saw this. I saw this little person that looked exactly like his father. And he was so beautiful. And he looked so little in that bed. And I saw his, you know, when they sleep in their little lips, and he just looked so tiny. And as I started to walk toward my son, thank you, I felt this like warmth in my chest, and I was like mesmerized because I saw my kid. He was 5 and I saw him. And I went toward him and I sat on the bed, and I'd been out drinking for 3 days. I reeked of alcohol. And he opened his eyes and he grabbed my hand and he started to rub my hand. And my son, not my mommy, not my daddy, not my therapist, not my sponsor, my little 5-year-old looked at me and he said, Mama, he goes, when are you gonna come home and be with us and not go away anymore? And in that instant, I was willing to be willing to do whatever it took. I never wanted to drink alcohol again. And I know I'm standing here this morning. It was not my childhood. It was not my dad. It was not the divorce. It was not the infidelities. Everything that was going wrong in my life and me circling the drain was over a clear liquid. For God's sakes, people, this is over a liquid, or in some cases, substances. And the love I had for a liquid had become more than the love I had for my own children. And I'm never going to be proud to share that. But for whatever reason, I said a prayer that I believe every alcoholic needs to say for themselves. Don't say it for your sponsor, for yourself. And I actually looked up and I said, God, please help me. And I went down to my home group, and there was an old timer there that used to tell the guys he sponsored, stay away from Blondie, she's bad news. And he was opening it up, and there was a guy that used to park an old beat up RV for wet drunks coming off a drunk that had no money for a hotel. And here I am, a surgeon's wife with this beautiful house, and I slept in that beat up old RV in the back of the hole in the sky that night. And I never felt more at peace than I did that night, because I wasn't gonna quit drinking one more time. I was finished. And the next morning I crawled out and I found this mean old timer, Cowboy Nick. And I said, I did not say, I need this and I need that and I want that and I think that. I said, Nick, I just lost custody of my children. My husband threw me out. I have nowhere to live. And instead of saying what I wanted, I said, I will do anything. Can you help me? I don't ever want to drink again. And that's magic to our old timer's ears. And he put his hand out and he said, sweetheart, your arms are too short to box with God. Why don't you put your hand in mine and let me help you? And I grabbed his hand. And then he put a mop in my hand and told me to mop the entire clubhouse. And I have not had a drink since, and that was 31 years ago. You know, my first year of sobriety, we do not promise you that, but it took me a year to get custody back of my children. I actually received custody at 8 months of sobriety, but I was sleeping on my sponsor's couch, and I went, and he went to court with me, and he saw that I got them back. He said, but you made a commitment that you were gonna live with me for a year, not 8 months. And I said, I know, but the judge says I'm entitled. Don't ever tell your sponsor what you're entitled to or your mentors. And he said, no, for the first time in your life, kid, you're gonna be a woman of your word, and you will stay for a year. And that was the longest 120 days because I wanted to get in the big bed and be back with my husband. And I'm really grateful for that, because it was the first time I took direction I did not want to take, I did not believe in, and staying away from your kids for 120 days when I thought they needed me, they did not need me. And you know, and things started to change for me. At 1 year of sobriety, a whole room started to sing happy birthday to me. And I had told you all that year I believed in God, but I want to let you know, when my little daughter was on the other side of that cake with the one candle handing me that cake, I had gone 365 days without taking a drink, and I knew there was a God that day. Through the grace of God and Al-Anon, Dr. Rick decided to give me a chance to come home and raise those kids as a sober mom, and he is a better person than I am. I don't know, after what I had put him through, that I could have been that strong. And we're, you know, tripping down AA and Al-Anon Lane now. At 1 year of sobriety, I remember telling my sponsor, you know, I've got a year sober, and I'm, you know, active and in meetings, and the kids are doing great, and my husband's in Al-Anon, and life is perfect, and I'm going back to school, and I just signed up for 15 units. He's like, good a-hole, now go drop 11 of them. He goes, you do not plan AA around your busy little life. You plan your busy little life around AA, and you go take 15 units. He goes, you're going to start calling me, oh, it's finals week, can't make my meetings, oh, can't do this. That sucker made me go to college 4 units at a time. You know, I came in here a college dropout. I stand before you. Check this out, man. I don't have one. I have 2 master's degrees. Clancy said I am educated way beyond my intelligence. I can't even find my car in a parking lot. But because I did it 4 units at a time and learned how to sit up front and take direction, and guess what my degrees are in? The art of language. I'm an English language arts teacher for the past 28 years. Man, I taught your kids. I taught your grandkids. That should scare you, you know? And I came in here cussing like a drunken sailor, and I learned the art of language. I took the direction. I always took the direction. And all my friends are graduating before me, and I'm like, you know, this with Clancy, but you know what? Something intuitively told me that he always had my best interest at heart, and he did. The kids start doing well at 12 years of sobriety. I'll end with this. Rick made a fatal Al-Anon mistake. He's got a sober wife. I've got 12 years sober. I'm working. I'm contributing to the family income. I'm there for the kids, PTA, you know, sponsoring, speaking, AA. And he decided his problem was solved, and he quit going to Al-Anon. Within a year, he came home and he told me, Tammy, I've met another woman. She's younger than you, she's prettier than you, and she's more fun than you, and I'm going to be leaving her for you. And I thought I was going to die. And I'm traveling around speaking how he went to Al-Anon and I went to AA, and we've put this family together. And within 1 year, we had to put my son in a wilderness camp to save him from the drugs he was killing himself with. And my daughter's in therapy for severe depression. And all of a sudden, Tammy's AA story went to pot. I've got a husband leaving me for another woman, so I'm a failure as a wife. I've got a daughter being treated for severe depression, and I have a son that's so addicted to marijuana that I have to send him away to Utah to try to save his life. And I felt like I had no story in AA and I didn't belong. And I'm going to meetings and I'm just not telling anybody. And my current husband, Patrick, and this is the value of a home group, we went to the same Sunday meeting. He saw me come in. And he said, Tammy, he walked up to me, and my mentor had just died. So I lost my husband, you know, my kids, and now my mentor's dead, and I'm just keeping it all here because I'm too embarrassed to tell AA that none of my story is the same anymore, and probably it never really was, you know. I believed my own press. And Patrick walked up to me, and he said, sweetheart, he goes, you can fool the masses, but you're not going to fool me. And Cowboy Nick was a good friend of mine, and he worked really hard with you for the last 12 years, and I want to know what's going on. And I told him the truth, and he said, you show up tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. at the Valley Club to a meeting. And he had a seat next to him every day for months. And I couldn't eat, and I was going through a divorce I didn't want to go through. And I remember saying to Patrick, can you help me save my marriage? He goes, sweetheart, I haven't had a lot of luck in that department. But he said, if it ends in divorce, I can show you how to do that sober. And I said, you got 25 years sober, and that's the best you got? He goes, that's the best I got. A year later, I came to Patrick, and I said, it's ending in divorce. For God's sakes, how do you do this sober? And he walked me through that, and we became a boy meets girl on AA campus, and I was literally the last to know. You know, everyone's like, every time you talk about Patrick, you have a sparkle in your eye. And I'm like, oh, shut up. That's Patrick, you know? And they were right. And one day he called me and said he was going to ask a girl on a date, and I was so jealous. And I realized that I had developed strong feelings for him. So I walked through that painful divorce, and at one point, because he was a surgeon and we opened that practice together, the practice made $1 million a year, and I was entitled to half of it because I was officer of the corporation, plus alimony and child support. And I went to Clancy and I said, I still love Rick. Like, this is so acrimonious. And he got an attorney and I got an attorney, and he said, sweetheart, what are you going for? And I said, I don't know. The lawyers tell me I'm entitled. Again, don't ever tell your sponsor what you're entitled to. And he said, Tammy, that guy put up with your drinking. He put up with 12 years of your sobriety. He put you through school. You have 2 master's degrees. You are self-supporting. You will never again live like a doctor's wife. But Rick has done his job, and you didn't go to medical school, so what do you want to be, have half of a medical practice? And he goes, what do you want? And I said, I guess I just want the kids to stay in the house, and I want them to stay in their schools. I don't want any more disruption. He goes, well, why don't you just ask him for the house and give him the medical practice? My attorney fired me. He said, that practice is worth $500,000 a year. Your house is worth like $500,000. Are you out of your mind? But I took Clancy's advice. There has been many nights that I have regretted that conversation with Clancy. But I have never had a sleepless night. And Rick and I became the best of friends. And he said that he could not believe that people could really change. And he said, Tammy, you are not the same woman. And that has been worth more to me than $500,000 a year or alimony and child support. And I could tell you, I came in always dependent on men, and I could stand before you today. I have my own medical insurance. I can provide it for my kids. I can pay my own mortgage. And what a freedom. And my husband, Patrick, knows that I am not with him because I have to be. He knows I'm here because I want to be. And when you're in a marriage where you feel dependent, I think they always wonder, are they really there? And what a freedom and a gift that's been that I didn't know. Rick fell really ill in 2013, and my daughter calls me and said, Mommy, Daddy's nurses just called and said he hasn't been to work in 2 days. Dr. Rick has not missed a day of work in 42 years. And he's an OBGYN, so he's always on call. And I said, Chelsea, something's wrong. So she called, she was the next to kin, and said, you know what, to his medical assistants, this is his address, go see if you can find him, because we couldn't reach him either. They go, and the lights are on, the TV's on, his car's parked, and he's not answering the door. So Chelsea had them break in, and we found Rick on the floor in full sepsis, in a coma, barely viable with life. They rushed him to the hospital, and they told us that he is not viable with life. He was fully septic, and it turned out that Rick had the effects of Agent Orange, and that he was doing a surgery on a Thursday. He started to feel a lot of back pain. He scrubbed out and said, I'm going to go lay down. Fainted that night with full body sepsis, and had been unconscious for 4 days, and the doctors couldn't believe he lived that long. Patrick and I and the kids went all the way up at this point. He's living in Fresno. And we're there, and by the way, that woman he left me for, I know nobody believes this, but she's literally a worse alcoholic than I was. And he learned that alcoholics have a compulsion for alcohol, and Al-Anons have a compulsion for the chaos of alcoholics. And he realized now what a mistake he had made, but he's laying dead, and they told us he's not viable, but just we'll keep him alive on life support and just have his kids be able to come and say goodbye. And I had to walk my daughter in, who was engaged to be married, and he was supposed to do the father-daughter dance. And we had to be in full hazmat suits because he was fully septic. He was completely yellow. He was in a coma. He had the trach. The machines were breathing for him. And I held her hand in our hazmat suits, and she said, Daddy, nobody was supposed to walk me down the aisle but you. And Clancy told me, you put on your big girl panties and be there. That's their father. And I did my job. And then I took my son, and he just looked at his dad on the machines, and he started to shake and cry. And he walked out, and I just gave him to Patrick in the hall, and he held my son. Then Patrick went in, and they said, sometimes they can hear in a coma. And Patrick went up to Rick's ear, and he said, Buddy, he said, I will not let any harm come to Tammy or your children. And you go on home and take an Emmy for a life well lived, because I know, sir, that you do not want to live like this. And finally, it was my turn, and I went in, and I said, I thanked Rick for saving me in every way that a woman could have been saved. And I thanked him for believing in me when I didn't believe in myself, and I looked at him, this beautiful triathlete, always ate healthy, dedicated his life to our country and to his profession. And I looked at him and I remember saying to God, why him? Why him and not me? He was such a good person. And I thanked him for saving me, and I promised him that no harm will ever come to his children, that I will stay sober and be the sober woman that he helped me to become. And I told him to also go on home because I knew he didn't want to live like that. And as I turned out from the room, I walked back and I whispered in his ear and I said, but Ricky, I know you. And you're a fighter, and so help me God, dude, if you can hear me and you got any fight, you give it your all, and Patrick and I and the kids will be with you 100% of the way. He didn't die that night. He remained on life support for 15 days. And after 15 days, he started to wake up, and they were able to bring him up out of the coma, and he started to breathe. It took him 5 months. He could not walk or talk. And on Christmas Day, they told us, or Christmas Eve, right, Patrick? They called and said, he's viable with life, but he will never walk or talk again. You cannot care for him. Find him a boarding care facility and bring him down. They were going to do either a medevac or an ambulance transport down to Chatsworth, where we lived. And I called Clancy, and I said, Clancy, I'm looking at all these places, and this beautiful man's life is going to be reduced to a twin bed and a little nightstand. And I started to cry, and I said, Clancy, what do you do when none of your options are okay? He said, Tammy, you do the next indicated thing. Now go find him a place near you and the kids. You sign the paperwork, you get him there, and you and the kids and Patrick go see him and make sure he gets the care he needs till the good Lord calls him home, because it probably won't be long, and the doctors told us that. So I signed all the paperwork, and when I came home, I'd been gone for a long time. Patrick's construction truck, Patrick is a contractor, and his construction trucks had filled our entire cul-de-sac, and I'm like, what's going on? And I see these guys like in and out of our house. Patrick and his guys had gone downstairs and gutted an entire second floor, and they made special showers with pulleys. They ordered a $6,000 hospital bed. We had special toilets, and through the grace of God, the love of a good ex-wife, definitely Patrick's cooking, a lot of physical therapy, a lot of occupational therapy, Dr. Rick was able to learn how to walk and talk again. He lived with us for 6 years, you know, and kudos to my husband. You know, there's a lot of gentle men in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my current husband bathed and fed my ex-husband for 6 years. And Rick was able, Chelsea postponed her wedding, and he was able to do the father-daughter dance. He is still alive today. And we did not even move to Northern California. We were going to, but we wanted to make sure he was okay. And Patrick and I bought a house with an extra bedroom, and we told Dr. Rick, if you start to not be well, that room's got your name on it. And what a gift. You know, I couldn't even be there for my own children. And through the grace of God, I've been able to come full circle with my ex-husband. When my mom was in hospice, Patrick and I took her, and he took my mom everywhere to all her little medical appointments. And my mom's from England, and Patrick's from Ireland, and those two like adored each other. What a blessing that's been. You know, Patrick was diagnosed with stage 4 throat cancer in 2020. Many of you have walked that journey with us. And he has been there for my children, for my grandchildren, for my ex-husband, and for both my parents. And this time it was his turn. And they had to remove his entire voice box. They gave him 4 months to live. He lived on a feeding tube and actually lived in a chair for an entire year. He couldn't even lay down in a bed. And you know, you think you know the grace and the soul of a man, but I want to tell you that my husband never has once complained. And when we relocated to Northern California in LA, he loved being on the coffee crew at the Pacific Group. He had his buddies, he golfed with Bouchard, all those guys. And I relocate him up north because we thought he only had a few months to live and we wanted to be near the kids, and my kids live up there. And you know, I'm up there sucking my thumb saying, I can't make friends and I don't like the AA. And he can't even talk. He can't golf now because he doesn't really know people. He's my favorite talking AA, and that voice has been silenced, and yet he's never complained. And you know what? What a teacher. And he hates this crap, but you know, honestly, Patrick, he won't let me say it in person because he'll just walk out of the room. But you know, he may not be the richest or the most educated guy in the world, but I'll tell you what, man, he's number one in my book.
That's right.
You know, I've been able to be there for my mother, for my children. I have the two of the most beautiful little grandsons you'd ever want to see, and I'm such a, like, boy grandma, because I'm into sticks and mud, and my kids want me to take care of their kids. What a gift. If you don't like your script in Alcoholics Anonymous, you get to rewrite it here. Find yourself an old-timer that cares more about your life than your feelings. Find someone that's got some experience and doesn't want you to necessarily like them. I see the popular sponsors. I've always gone for the ones that just tell me the truth, because you know what? I want to know the truth because I already know it. I'm just sick of defending it all the time. I thank God for AA. I thank AA for God. And heck, I thank each and every one of you for sitting here through this. Thanks so much.
That's right.